Hey, this is Kate. I'm a forensic psychologist and crisis clinician, and I collect stories. Everything from true crime to trauma to parenthood. There's a lot more in common between depression and sociopathy, or between serial killers and podcasters, than you might think. Are you sure you really want to know? This is Ignorance Was Bliss at iwbpodcast.com and iwbpodcast on social media.
Hi, this is Mouse.
I'm Weens.
We have the Mouse and Weens podcast.
Mouse and Weens.
I'm a big sister in San Diego with kids, and I'm married.
And I have no friends. No, I'm just kidding. No, I do. I have friends. I just don't have any boyfriends or love. Anyway, Mouse and Weens podcast, you should listen to it.
Yeah,
it's not really depressing.
Fun. We talk about family stories, life and love, and kids, and all the things you're interested in. We promise.
Yay!
Celebrities in Hollywood, too.
Poke your little turtle head out and come listen to us.
Mouse and Weens. Bye. Bye.
Hello, and welcome to The Picture Show. With Austin and Phil Rude. I'm half of the hosts of this show. I'm Austin, and I'm the son.
And I am Phil Rude. I am the dad, and I am here to find the murderer.
Is that what we do on this show?
That's what we're doing this week.
Fair enough, fair enough.
The game is afoot. Oh. Wrong, European detective. Sorry.
You've got the right idea.
I'm pointing it in the right direction. I'm Phil Rude. I'm the dad. Every week on the show, we watch a movie, we get on mic, and we talk about it.
Yes, we do. But before that, do we have anything to talk about other than our mystery that's afoot?
Other than the... Oh, you did it this time.
That's right.
Nothing's afoot here.
Okay.
Yeah, I wrapped up, my NaNoWriMo project this week. The first draft. There's a lot of work to do. And I watched some old movies. I watched some films of the 70s this week. I revisited some of the kind of great new Hollywood offerings that are streaming right now. I watched Apocalypse Now because I love that movie. And I feel like it's something I like to check in with every couple of years. And the Redux version is on Netflix right now.
Redux?
It was like a re-edit. They put a bunch of like stuff cut from the theatrical cut back in. So there's like 45 minutes or an hour more. I like it less than the actual theatrical version, but it's still a super compelling movie. And I watched Taxi Driver. I watched 1976's... Taxi Driver with Robert De Niro, Jodie Foster, Harvey Keitel, Sybil Shepherd, Albert Brooks, Peter Boyle. Great movie.
They are the big 70s
movies. Big 70s, yeah. Scorsese did The Irishman a couple years ago. It was a big movie that everybody was talking about. And I think the best part of him making The Irishman for Netflix is that Netflix got all of his really great movies from like the 70s and through the 80s, like Raging Bull and stuff like that. So they got that stuff on there. So a lot
That's
of that stuff
cool.
is accessible. And yeah, I hadn't seen Taxi Driver in quite a while. And it was cool to revisit that too. Picked up a little bit more of let that movie sink in. Both of these movies are things that, like, every time I watch them, a little bit more of it sinks in. It clicks with me a little bit more.
I mean, we all know Taxi Driver is just kind of a cheap knockoff of
kinda,
the Joker.
It's kind of derivative of Joker, yes.
But, you know, it's still got some merits to it, I guess.
He's no Joaquin Phoenix, but, you know, in all seriousness, Joaquin Phoenix is great in Joker. I just don't think Joker is a great movie. I think Joaquin Phoenix is a great actor. But Taxi Driver it is a raw, kind of hard to watch movie, but it is really, really good. It's sort of like everything about that era of movies, I think. Taxi Driver kind of defines that. The anti-heroes, the weird loners. And I watched a YouTube video about the like the literally me. They call it the literally me character, and it is like these characters like Joker and like Ryan Gosling in not Baby Driver, Drive, and Robert De Niro in Taxi and things like that, Taxi Driver, and things like that, where people sort of glom onto them and they're like the toxic people who admire like the terrible things about it. But really, like, the phenomenon that a lot more people do actually identify with these characters, not because they're dangerous characters, but because they're outsiders and they're sort of, you know, we've all felt alienated. We all feel like we don't fit in sometimes, and we all feel lost and drifting sometimes. And that there's something about the way a good portrayal of these kind of characters can lock into that thing with you, which I thought was really interesting. It wasn't just about toxic fanboys. It was about the sort of universal truth of, like, feeling like you don't fit in anywhere. You know what
well,
I mean?
Well, that's kind of what I think those movies are written about.
Absolutely. Yeah.
The whole point is you're meant to relate to these characters and then be like, oh, look at what this...
Oh, they took it too far.
You know, kind of like, look at what holding on to these feelings of isolation and loneliness and holding grudges against society because of that, what that leads to.
Right. Almost like cautionary tale kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like Fight Club.
But Fight Club came to mind when I was thinking that. But then again, like...
It's the same kind of thing where it's like, oh, you can take this too far.
It's just the people that don't see the obvious sign that the movie is trying to show that they did take
it. This isn't supposed to be something to aspire to. This is supposed to be a little more cautionary than that.
Yeah.
But yeah. Yeah. Then I think there's something about that era, too, because it is like you're dealing with trauma from Vietnam. A lot of these characters, like the Travis Bickle in Taxi Driver, is a Vietnam vet. Oliver Stone, who was writing a lot of stuff at that time, was a Vietnam vet. I think Paul Schrader, who wrote Taxi Driver, I think he was a Vietnam vet. And like a lot of these, the trauma from that sort of translated into these characters. It's all really interesting. And then, of course, like Apocalypse Now is a Vietnam War movie.
Well, that's you can see in a lot of 70s stuff and even stuff set in the 70s that's just... Yeah. That takes over that era, kind of, because but, it had a big impact.
For sure, yeah. Or the fallout from it. You know, even, like, the blockbusters after Vietnam were sort of almost a response to Vietnam. In, like, okay, we're going to give you escapism now, because we've been carrying this burden around for so long. You know, like...
I hear a lot of people talk about what 9/11 has kind of done to horror, like... There's a lot more people falling from, like, buildings and stuff for, like, height and explosions, like, in horror, specifically post-9/11.
Horror has always kind of, there's, like, untold video essays and papers written about how horror is actually the most, like, socially conscious genre. It's always been, like, a reflection of the, even like back to like Godzilla is a story about atomic fallout. It's in response to,
we find ways to cope with what's going on.
For sure. That's really interesting, to go down that road too. But, I see you have something not related to 9/11.
That's right. This movie didn't even mention 9/11. No, I watched Turning Red, last week, because this is Turning Red and Luca are two specific Pixar films that me and my boyfriend, we both like really wanted to watch, but because we're long distance, we were like, we're gonna wait till we're in person together
to have a
movie night. It doesn't, because we didn't even get to watch Luca. We ran out of time, but we did watch Turning Red and we both loved it. It falls under, there's this weird thing with, like, Encanto has this too, where it's like, let's talk about generational, like, trauma in animated movies, where it's really almost like they're gearing these, like, they're kids' movies, but also they're kind of gearing them towards adults and, like, answering really existential questions. Kind of like, what was the... What was the Pixar movie about death just not long ago?
Soul.
Soul, yeah. Yeah. It's the same kind of thing of they're dealing with these big questions.
And also Coco.
Coco
it,
as
is
well,
very
yeah.
thematic. I think Pixar's always... Pixar's always been thematic. They've all, even like Toy Story is about moving on. It's about moving... The Toy Story trilogy is about Andy. It's really like about Andy's relationship to his toys as he gets older.
Yeah.
You know, and these sort of bigger things that aren't about the main focus of the thing.
That's what Pixar is great at. And yeah. Turning Red is all about like this family. They're kind of cursed with like everyone gets their red panda, but don't worry because it's like a werewolf situation. They turn into a red panda, but they're able to cast a spell at the full moon and contain this so that they never are able to turn into the red panda again. And of course, the teenage protagonist, she ends up liking her red panda and embracing what makes her unique despite her family
right.
wanting to repress her. It's a really interesting concept.
It's like Teen Wolf.
It's exactly like Teen Wolf. That's right.
Teen Wolf was about a boy who embraced being a werewolf.
I have not seen Teen Wolf.
Yes, well, it's a silly 80s comedy. Are you, but it sounds like very, honestly, very similar. Like, it is a family trait, and he basically becomes like a celebrity because of it.
Interesting. Is that related to the show Teen Wolf?
Yes, but it like the show was very edgy and dark.
It's like a Riverdale version. That's why.
Right. It's the 80s teen comedy starring Michael J. Fox was Teen Wolf.
See, I didn't even know that was a
thing.
Where
he just became a high school basketball star because he had wolf powers. It's very silly.
Yes. We all know that one guy.
You know that guy.
Yeah. But that is my review of Turning Red.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Cool. You enjoyed it then.
I did. But in other news... There is something we watched this week.
There is.
And we will spend a lot of time talking about that. This week, we watched the latest Agatha Christie adaptation. It is Death on the Nile. This is following the events of Murder on the Orient Express. The world-renowned detective, Hercule Poirot.
Hercule Poirot.
We said
Come on,
the same thing.
Get Belgian. Let's get some waffles in here. We're going to get Belgian with this.
I added as much accent as I physically can. I've got my fake mustache on. I thought it would do the trick. Hercule Poirot. Close enough. He takes a break from his cases and goes on what is meant to be a simple vacation. But unfortunately, he can't get away that easily. And he quickly finds himself... in the middle of a very disastrous honeymoon full of unsavory and petty rich people. Death on the Nile is written by Michael Green, adapted from Agatha Christie's works, and is directed by Kenneth Branagh. It stars everyone. Everyone in the world is in this movie.
It stars Kenneth Branagh as Poirot.
And it stars Armie Hammer as Simon.
Gal Gadot as Lynette.
Annette Bening as Ephemia.
Letitia Wright is Rosalia.
Tom Bateman is Buck.
Russell Brand is Dr. Ludwig.
Emma Mackey is Jacqueline.
That's right. Plus more. There's a ton of people in this movie.
There's a lot of small roles. It's an Agatha Christie story.
It's an ensemble. You said this follows the events of Murder on the Orient Express, but it doesn't. You know, yes, it's after that, but like it's not a sequel in the way anything carries over from that. But it is the same formula. There's a huge ensemble cast because you have to have a huge number of suspects. In an Agatha Christie mystery.
Right, you've got to have a lot of red herrings. I do think it is a sequel in terms of Poirot, his character, is kind of going through...
It's a sequel in the way that, like, James Bond movies are sequels.
Yeah.
They go in order, but with the exception of a couple small groups of movies, they don't have any real continuity to them. You know what I mean? Like, it's just sort of the adventures of this character.
Yeah.
And I think all Agatha Christie's characters were like that.
I think especially with, I mean, these movies, they're making them as if this is one after the other, but like, I think there's like a bunch of books between Murder on the Orient Express and this one. So they're just kind of picking and choosing what stories and putting them in whatever order they please.
I don't know if they're doing like the Poirot stories, or if they're going to do like Miss Marple, or I don't remember all of her other detectives, because she had a series of characters that she would write stories about. So they may just be right now doing these, and then, you know, later on do the PBS model, where they just, you know, sort of adapt all of them eventually, and they kind of exist in the same kind of universe. I say PBS, but I think those are all BBC.
I think BBC things.
You have BritBox. Is all the Poirot stuff, the BBC stuff on there?
They do have quite a few Agatha Christie. I don't know if they have all of it on there. I might have to check on that.
That's interesting. I might be interested to watch some more of that.
Yeah. I haven't seen any of those though, and it's not in the same style, I think, as these movies.
These are very modern looking. They take place in the old days, but like, these are very, very much modern filmmaking.
They're very polished. Yes. Yeah. And I think I like that about them. I don't know if I would. I mean, it depends on how the suspense is covered, but I don't know how I would feel about, like, let me just switch over to any Agatha Christie adaptations.
Yeah, I'm sure it's a lot lower budget than these are.
With the BBC, I mean, come on.
You know. But where do you want to start with this? It's your show, bud.
Oh, boy.
Take the wheel.
Steer the ship, you might say.
Ooh, well done.
That's right. I don't know. I want to start with... Okay, my initial thoughts is that this movie felt very flat and slightly boring in the beginning. Like, I feel like it didn't start to be a movie until the murder happened.
I agree.
Which is really cool. Like, there's a specific moment I can pinpoint where Poirot kind of, like, faces the camera and, like, says he's on the case. It's very on the nose, but it is... Like, that is when the momentum of this story starts to build for me. And that's when I started to feel invested and not like this was dragging, which it felt like before.
The beginning of this movie was both, I don't want to say uninteresting. That's probably not totally fair. But it just sort of was spinning wheels. And at the same time, like, and I felt the same way. I remember feeling the same way with Orient Express. You're given so much information because that's what the front of these stories is. They're just front loading it with, these are all the characters. Here's how they all relate to each other. Here's, we're going to plant all the motives for everybody.
Yeah, all the motives are there before.
All the information. And it is, there are so many characters and it is so overwhelming that it's you're trying to keep it all straight in your head until, like, by the time the murder happens, then you kind of have more of a sense of who everybody is and what their possible motivations are, and it isn't really that overwhelming. But you're right, like, the front half of this movie is kind of frustrating in that there isn't a lot happening and you have a lot of information that you're trying to digest.
It's like it's solely exposition.
For sure.
And there's things in there that, like, there's a story in there. I mean, Perot's on vacation. That's like a beginning part.
Or is he?
Yes, we find out later. He is on a secret mission hired by Book's mother.
Yep.
But either way, like, he's there in the beginning, it's a soft start, and then we get into kind of, oh, he witnesses this drama, he happens to run into the same exact people 6 months later.
Right.
I'm gonna ignore that logical fallacy for now, but, like, there's the attempted murder at the tomb, there's the introduction to the ship, there are these things that feel like they should be points that build momentum in the story, but it all just feels very flat because it's like they're not even, the director doesn't care about that. He's just dumping all the exposition right now. I feel like
it's the way the story, I think, probably is originally told. And these are like formulaic stories. You know what I mean? These are the Pixar or the Marvel movies of their day, you know, it, as far as like, there is a formula to them. You spend the first half setting it up. And I will say, the pyramid, where they get off and they're exploring like the pyramid, which, by the way, I love the idea of going to see ancient ruins with no tour guide. You're just able to walk around them.
And just rich people, just like, we bought just our like way
the day, the day before, like a tourism industry, you know what I mean? Where it was just sort of like, you could just go to these places and just be, you could climb on the pyramids of Giza.
You know, just break a statue, no one minds. Right.
But I'll say when they're exploring the one castle or the pyramid or the tomb or whatever it was,
mm-hmm.
Right before the murder happens, I think that's about where it starts to pick up for me. More things are happening. You start to see the relationships that the characters have. You get to know that, like, Book and is it Letitia? No, it's not Letitia. The young...
It's Rosalia.
Yes.
I knew who you were talking about. I couldn't think of the name.
The manager of the band, the young black lady. You start they're together, and you know that. And it's like, okay, the secrets are starting to be revealed, you know? And by the way, the guy who tried to drop the stone on them, that guy just gets away scot-free for attempted murder at the end of the movie.
I thought he said he was going to be taken in by the police.
Oh, did he?
When they're getting off the boat.
Oh, okay. Maybe I missed that, but I thought it was just sort of like, oh, wait a minute. He never had to do anything.
It is very funny how he admits to it, and then he's like, but I would never kill her.
Yeah, I don't know what came over me. I just felt like dropping a giant boulder on
you. Just a little impulsive.
Yeah,
silly
seriously.
Old me.
But yeah, I think there's a lot to that, and if you haven't seen this movie or you aren't planning to see this movie and you want something comparable to it, like the modern day equivalent of this would be like Knives Out. Like, I think that is very much an Agatha Christie style mystery.
But I think specifically Knives Out, the first half where it's all set up works better because it's formatted for a movie. I feel like the flaws that are in here, like, it's just a direct adaptation of the book's plot. Like, they didn't, like, change little here and there to kind of fit it more into the movie
style. Have you read this book?
I never finished this book, but I do own it, and I read about halfway through it. I did not remember anything. It was just kind of one of those books, like, things got in the way. I enjoyed the book, but as we were watching the movie, I started remembering, like, oh, those are the two friends, and they're fighting over the guy, and
all of this stuff
that was introduced heavily in the book. I was like, oh, okay, I have a better understanding of this.
I have a question because you just said this is a direct adaptation. I have a question about the book, because that book is super old, and this movie feels super modern in some ways, and one of those ways is the very diverse cast. Is there an interracial romance in the book? Is there a lesbian romance in the book? Are there dark-skinned people intermingling with these rich European white people. Like, I just, that feels very modern to me. And I'm not saying that that didn't exist in books and things like that. And I'm not even saying it as a negative here. But it did stand out to me as very odd that, like, boy, they're, this rich white lady went to boarding school with this black lady.
Right.
Like, how is that even possible in this time period?
I'm very curious. I don't remember the lesbians, and I don't remember the singer or her daughter being black, but I don't know if it wasn't mentioned in the book or,
right.
But I remember there was some, I think it was like a class status thing was more the issue the mom had.
I mean, that's for sure there, but it, like, that was part of what struck it for me, is because you understand that Rosalie is a lower class, not just because she's black, but just because she's managing a band. Mm-hmm. And her aunt, who apparently raised her, is kind of like a rough and tumble, kind of shady, you know, I've been married 5 times and she carries a gun on her. I mean, it's like this real, like, the old blues musicians were like kind of gangstery. You know what I mean? Like, and it's like, there's no way she came from money enough to go to boarding school with her. I mean, it's just, it's a weird thing to think about, like, oh, in the 1920s, would a young black girl who doesn't come from money be able to go to boarding school with, like, the richest of rich white families?
There is a weird thing there. One thing the book gets into that I remember is that they weren't like super wealthy, because the jealous lover in this,
Jacqueline,
right. Yeah, she and Rosalia and the dead bride, they all went to school together,
right?
But Lynette, her family got more wealthy and they earned more estates, and they go into that.
Yeah,
they go into it in heavy detail in the book. It's like a whole chapter.
It's very implied here that Lynette became wealthy, basically when the stock market crashed. It's like the people who bet on the economy to fail in 08 and bought all like the junk bonds or whatever the thing. I don't know exactly how it all works, but it's like, he almost benefited from the stock market crash that ruined all these other families, including like the nurse on the boat.
Yeah, the nurse was,
you know, talks about
pretending to be wealthy.
Right. And like, that's one of my favorite like Poirot moments, is when he like calls her out. He's like, you have all this designer shit, but it's old. And it's pat, like these are like the detective moments in like Sherlock Holmes, and everything else that I love the most is when he does like the parlor trick of it, of like sizing somebody up. And I think Kenneth Branagh as Poirot is, I think he's like note perfect for the way he does that. You know what I mean? He's not like flashy and showing off. He's just pointing out, you were rich and this is how I know.
He's a quirky little dude.
Yes.
And
he just,
oh, this, that. And you're a bit of a gambler because I, you know, did a little lie and stole your book. And found this out. And, like, just the little things he does are really clever.
Let's talk about the backstory.
Perot's backstory?
The origin story of his mustache, which, as ridiculous as it sounds, that's actually in here.
That is truly...
But I wanted to point this out because you made mention that you didn't like the idea of him having been a soldier. And I just wanted to explore that a little bit.
This was the very beginning of the movie opens on him.
It's a World War I flashback.
Yes, and he saves his kind of troop using very clever tactics of the wind and gas. And I thought it was a cool scene, but I was like, this feels weird. Like, because the character that we knew in the last movie, I'm like, I don't see him as a soldier type. And I think what I'm seeing in that is that the effects of him being a soldier. I think it's kind of embedded into the character that now he's a bit more of a pacifist. I mean, goes a little kooky at the end of this one. waving a gun around.
He is a little bit coming off the rails at the end here.
But,
yeah.
But I don't think that he has it in him to hurt people, is what struck me as weird. Like,
sure.
And so that was my gut reaction. But as the movie went on, I was like, kind of, this makes more sense. And especially for the time when, like, it's just kind of expected as for you as a man.
Well, and also this is in Europe, in a war that affected all of Europe.
Right. This is a really heavy time. People are trying to protect their country.
I think it was a really different time, even in like World War II. People like Jimmy Stewart, people like Ted Williams, people who were famous celebrities went to war, you know, because it was, they understood, like, this affects us all. It was a different military culture than we have today. It wasn't like a heavy PR, you know, firm behind it. And it just, like, I think it does make sense that that he was a soldier, just having been from that time. But you're right. It's an almost out of place sequence. It is weird, because it is almost like it's an origin story. It does sort of like point to this idea of why he's alone, that he was in love with this woman at one point, and you know, for whatever reason, you know, he ended up alone and he doesn't want to go through that again. And it's just sort of like a little bit of backstory, but it just is sort of like, I understand, like, this story is dealing with relationships as motives, and he wants to always stress that, like, people do insane things for love. And, like, that's sort of like the mantra of this movie. So it makes sense that they want to show that, like, yes, he does know what he's talking about. But, like, that whole sequence just, it does seem very, very out of place.
Especially at the start, and I think there's a reason for that. It's not from the book.
Mm-hmm.
I'm willing to bet that backstory is in a different Perrault book, and they just spliced plot thread and put it in the second movie because they wanted to explain a little more of who this character
is.
But I do think it works well the more the movie goes on. I think I really love the scene where he gets a little too drunk talking to Jacqueline, and he, like, explains, like, this is what loss feels like. And he's kind of telling her, like, you got to move on, but you can see he hasn't moved on.
Right.
And I thought that was really touching. And it brings it back around when Book dies, because you can tell this is a longtime friend of his.
Yeah.
And this loss hits him in the same kind of way. It taps into the same thing of the loss of his wife or girlfriend at the time in the flashback. So right. I think it's really interesting how that all culminates in him kind of getting a little darker at the end of the story.
Yes, you get an actual character moment with him, as opposed to him just being the smartest detective with all the answers. You know what I mean? Like, to tie this to Sherlock Holmes again, like, you never understand Sherlock Holmes's backstory. You never get where he came from or what he did before he was the most famous consulting detective in the world.
Well, they try but fail at that, because they make it like he's a spy or whatnot in different adaptations.
I guess there probably are, like, little snippets, but, like, here, I mean, it is like he sort of learns the lesson that, like, you can't protect yourself from loss. Mm-hmm. And I think that comes around really nicely at the very end of the movie when he shaved his mustache off. Like, you kind of, we joked about, like, the origin story of the mustache while we were watching the movie. We're like, is this really what this is? Because he was scarred on his face. And then, like, you kind of come to understand, like, he's kind of hiding behind his mustache. Like, that's kind of what that is.
It's hiding his scarred past.
It's hiding his scarred past. He's protecting his emotions from being involved with people again. And then after he learns that, he comes around at the end and he goes to see the blues singer that he is catching feelings for. And he's shaved his mustache off. And I'm like, oh, that's kind of a nice little bookend to this story is he's sort of learning how to come back into the, it's like the Goodwill Hunting thing when Robin Williams convinces him, like, you can't protect yourself from being hurt. You have to go and do something again.
Yeah. I like that moment, and I also like, because you said, like, it reminds you that this is a human character, not right. just a great detective, because they're in the interrogation scene with Book.
With Book, yeah.
When he dies, and there's, like, a plot thing of where, like, he's about to tell us the answer to the story, and he dies, and we don't ever get that, but you would... My immediate reaction, and this could just be me, was, Perot, quick, have him whisper his last words that this is the answer. And Perot is completely forgotten about the mystery, or so it seems to me. Like, he's just holding his friend and, like, trying to stop the bleeding. Right. And it's like, oh shit, this isn't just another case for him. This isn't just another... victim of murder. This is his best friend.
You do understand that, like, yeah, like, for a character we haven't seen before, they do establish really well that they're like, oh, they have known each other for a long time, and they are, you know, and Perot does like Book, that they are, I don't know about close, but as far as people on the boat that he can trust, he does trust Book. And he does, like, have a history with him.
I do think Book...
Plus, when you're shot in the throat, you can't whisper.
That's... Well, yeah. Very... okay.
I mean, Perot would know this.
The fact that you know it, you must be Perot. It's the mustache.
Yeah, the mustache That's holds it. All the power.
I do think we saw Book in the last movie, though. Correct me was if I'm wrong, there? But he was... There was a friend of his... who helped him get a ticket onto the train.
Oh.
Interesting. And there's, like, a scene where he's a bit of a scoundrel. I don't know if it's the same person, but I believe...
I need to rewatch that movie, because as much as I remember really liking that movie, in the same way that I do like this movie, regardless of, like, the slow start to it, but I don't remember a lot of the detail of that movie.
Yeah.
And I think, like, these movies may be what... the Mission Impossible movies are for me. And that, like, the last few Mission Impossible movies, I've seen them. I really like them. I have a good time with them. And then I forget all about them until the next one comes out. And I don't remember details of them.
It's because it's so fast.
It's just, it's
such a fast moving. I feel like it works really well as a companion piece. Like, sure. You can watch this and read the book, the book and then watch it. And, like, either way, that'll make either piece of media make a lot more sense.
Or possibly so connected. Watch another adaptation of it, like we were talking about. Watch those BBC things. Which, those things are... I've heard a lot of people who have the BritBox app or have access to BBC stuff talk about the Poirot series as, like, a really big deal that they really like. For people who love British TV, like, really like that stuff. So,
that's interesting.
I think it is just that tone, that BBC TV show tone. You know what I mean? Like, the dramas.
They,
like,
you they watch do that one, really well.
Is it Derry Girls? And,
Derry Girls is a comedy.
Right, but, like, there's a specific brand of comedy, there's a specific brand of, like, period drama. Like, there's a tone to all of their
things. See, I'm thinking right now of Broadchurch, which is, like...
That's more modern.
Yeah.
I'm talking about more like a period piece, like this, or, what's the one? It's, like, Doc Martin or something like that, about the, like...
A doctor or something.
Yeah, I don't know. Is he the guy who solves crimes, or is that just a doctor show? I don't know.
The ad is playing in my mind, but I can't. My gosh.
But yeah, no, it's like there's a real specific tone to that stuff.
Doc Brown.
Doc Brown?
Yeah.
That's the Back to the Future guy.
I swear it's Doc Brown.
Okay.
I'm gonna Wait, correct myself.
Doc Martin
in 5 minutes.
the boot guy. Yeah. Now we have to take a break and look this up.
That is what I'm doing right now.
Doc Martin. Yep.
Oh, Doc. Okay. All right.
I was right. I am. The mustache is doing it.
It's really helping you, isn't it?
It really is. I want to talk about Russell Brand real quick while we're stalled.
Okay. Who does he play again?
He's the doctor.
Okay. Yes.
Russell Brand. I did not even recognize him until I was like halfway through the movie. I pulled up the cast and I'm like, Russell Brand is in this movie, and he is so unrecognizable because he's had like. Long, he looks like a rock star all the times I've seen him. He's a British comedian.
Right, yeah. I've seen some of his stand-up, yeah. And so, yeah, I didn't place him at all watching
this. Yeah, and he is unrecognizable, but once I saw him, I'm like, oh, that is Russell Brand, and I think he's really good in this movie. I've never seen Russell Brand play a quiet and reserved character, and he really surprised me, because he did it, and he did it really well. I really kind of believed that he was this altruistic doctor who didn't want to just be a boring rich person, who legitimately wanted to help people, mm-hmm. and was trying to help on this boat with this case and help people. You know, I don't know. There was something about his character I found like really, he was like the most likable guy in the party, and. Just seeing Russell Brand play something different really, really surprised me in a good way.
He was the most boring in the way that, like, I did not notice him until his interrogation scene, pretty much. And then, the thing about you don't call yourself Lord, and he, like, goes into, like, he gave that up. He earned his title of doctor. I love that.
And yeah,
that is
I did
really
too.
Cool.
I did too. I liked the character, and I think that's what's so surprising is like you don't notice him. And every other time I've seen Russell Brand on screen, he's the guy in the shot who is screaming, sometimes literally, "Hey, look at me." He's always doing something big and bombastic and crazy to get. He's the comedian who wants all your attention. So to see him playing something so subtle, I was like, "Oh wow, that's really crazy."
I'm looking at his film credits right now, and they're all over the place.
Yeah.
But like they're all very like,
yeah.
Come down a little, bud.
He's got a wild drug past. Russell Brand is actually a really interesting guy, and I think he's one of the reasons that people reacted so strongly against this movie.
Is he one of the 500 people that were canceled?
I think he's either canceled or they're working on it. He has a YouTube channel that I kind of stumbled across. And I think the gist of the YouTube channel is about promoting critical thinking. I was not offended by anything that I saw on his channel. I watch a bunch of videos. They're all interesting. I don't agree with everything he says. He's not a COVID denier, but he is like, let's take a look at it and decide for yourself. You know, he's very much like a decide for yourself, look at the people in power and decide whether or not you want to believe them or not. And it's kind of an interesting channel, but I can understand how it can be really off-putting for a lot of people. And I have seen a lot of people like push back against it and be like, you know, he's doing damage and whatnot. I don't know. I don't take it that way, but I think I can see like how Twitter as a whole pushes back against things that really are kind of benign sometimes.
I've seen he's a little off-putting at times. I don't know much about him. One thing I will say,
he wrote a actually really good book about his experience with drug addiction and getting sober that I know some people have found very helpful to them. So,
and that's a good thing.
He has done a lot of work with his sobriety. I do know that. Yeah.
That's, you know, people contain multitudes.
That's exactly my point, is there's more dimensions to a lot of people than...
One bit of backlash that I have found out about. Okay, so real quick...
Armie Hammer eats people, I know.
Listen. If the right seasoning occurs, no.
We all saw Santa Clarita Diet.
We all get it. No, so Agatha Christie in recent years has been criticized heavily. She denies this on Twitter, but she was extremely racist in the way that a lot of the founders of like the women's suffrage movement in America were also very racist. That they were
very
like,
fashionable to be racist at that time.
I wonder why, but yes, it was an awful opinion that basically black women don't deserve the same rights we're fighting for as white women. And so a lot of people recently have been like, we need to acknowledge this. We need to talk about it. We need to not read her books because of it. And, you know, everyone... is able to decide for themselves. Personally, though, I am disgusted by certain authors like Lovecraft or J.K. Rowling, where their bigotry, when you know about it and look at their work, you can see the more subtle ways that it appears. And I don't see that in Agatha Christie's work. I'm not saying it's not there, but I don't personally see it. And especially in these adaptions, which, like you said, they have prominent people of color playing important roles, talking about the disparities that they face in this culture.
Sure.
Which is probably not in the books. And also they have gay characters, which is more of a plot point in the mystery of,
that
oh,
was
you
the most
have a secret.
That was the most organic way to put diversity into this story, I thought, was the two women who had a secret that Poirot found out and also was just sort of like, hey, I don't care. I'm just trying to get everything out in the open so we know what's what.
He's pulling all the loose threads.
He's pulling all the secrets out on the table so he can sort them out, you know?
Right, and that's like, just, with the big cast of characters, you're going to get diversity in that way. Sure. And just... I liked that.
Well, let's talk about the Agatha Christie right off the bat. I mean, there's... I listened to The Dollop, the podcast, the American History podcast. It's a comedy podcast, but it's also bringing out, like, the real stories of American history. Not the things you were taught. Here's what really happened. And historical figures. And there are tons... I mean... Our history is littered with people who were fighting for great causes, but also had very serious shortcomings in that way. Like, there are stories of people organizing labor unions. And then, like, black workers would be like, we want to join up and fight with you. And they're like, no. And they would actually lose their fights because they wouldn't bring everybody, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And it's just sort of like, this is their own downfall. And yes, you were fighting for something great. And yes, your intentions were great. And if you could have just got over this hurdle of being racist and included everybody, you know, you would have been that much better. But like, yes, historical figures, authors, so many of them have these dark spots. H.P. Lovecraft, you said it, everybody decide for themselves. I can read Lovecraft. I know it's there. I know what he was writing about. But I also know that's not all the substance of the story. There's also other great stuff. I told you last year, I watched a great video about H.P. Lovecraft. It was like a 2-hour video from In Praise of Shadows on YouTube. It's a great video essay about the complicated relationship he has with Lovecraft by, I love his work, and he was a really interesting person and really a very kind of sweet person in some ways, but he was also a horrible racist monster. And I know this, and this creates, like, you know, a complication of, can I separate this? If you can, more power to you. If you can't, I get that too. You know what I mean? Like, there are people against, who's the Harry Potter lady?
J.K. Rowling.
But also, they have no problem with Disney, who basically put everybody in place who built the Don't Say Gay bill. You know what I mean? Like, I know Disney is supposedly boycotting right now, but people have no problem with Disney. And I'm like, they have done more damage than J.K. Rowling has.
It's very selective in who people rally against,
right? It's easy to hate J.K. Rowling because she's not producing new things right now, and Disney holds the rights to our childhood franchises. You're right, it's very selective. I think people, and I'm not telling people to boycott Disney, I'm just saying I think being selective about who we're outraged at on Twitter has a lot to do with convenience and a lot to do with your personal I have no delusions about any public figure in entertainment, authors, actors, directors from like the 1930s that there wasn't.
They were all perfect, upstanding citizens. I don't know what you mean.
In the time when things were segregated and there was just a weird, completely unrecognizable society to what we have today, like, yeah, people were going to have their prejudices and they were probably going to be pretty public about that.
Everyone was complacent and
so it's not terribly surprising. I don't know what good canceling Agatha Christie does 100 years after she's dead, but it's one of those things I don't know how surprised anyone expects to be about stuff like that.
I think the main thing is bringing awareness to it so that you can think about biases that might be in the work that are kind of hidden, that might be affecting your internal biases. But ultimately, like, it is up to people to decide if they are okay reading certain things, watching things with canceled actors, and it is not up to other people to tell you whether or not you can watch that, or whether you're a bad person for reading
that. I agree with that 100%, because I like a lot of things that people have told me I'm not supposed to like, and that's just up to me. At the same,
like syrup, Aunt Jemima
syrup, I know, Uncle Ben's rice, all of these things that were the one thing holding all the racism together in this country was very cheap pancake mix. But on the other hand, I know our buddy David Ginsburg of the Tales from the Fandom, he does not allow Harry Potter fandom on his podcast anymore. Like, that's a show where people come on and talk about things they love, and he's like, you can talk about anything, but I don't support the Rowling, and I'm, you know, like, that's your platform. That's totally
up to you
how to run your platform. And he's not telling everybody, don't like Harry Potter. He's just like, you can't bring it on my show, and this is where I stand on it. And I think
that's the right way to do it.
Everybody has their own ability of how much they are able to separate, you know, art from artists, you know. You should be able to separate this and you should be able to separate that. And it's sort of like, well, if you're able to do that, that's great. Somebody else may have a harder time with that. And it depends on personal, it depends on so many things, you know what I mean? But, I pretty easily separate somebody's personal views from their work. Otherwise, I probably wouldn't enjoy hardly anything.
But, that is the state of being a creative.
That's kind of, you know, especially when you start getting into old-timey things. Something like this. It was created almost 100 years ago now. It's like, yeah, it was going to be created by somebody with some questionable worldviews. You go read Tarzan. Go read like the original Tarzan.
Oh boy,
it's a great book. It really is.
But I'm sure there's some questionable things in there.
It's dealing with native people and talking about them in kind of a way that is sort of like, oh yeah, they're kind of animals and savages in the way that Europeans used to write about indigenous people. It's not necessarily out of hate. It's more out of ignorance. It's like these people never met anybody and they're not open-minded enough to write in depth about them. So it's just easier to write them all off as like being savages and whatnot. And it's just sort of like, yeah, it's really problematic today. You know what I mean? Like, that's still a great book, but it's got some problematic stuff. And as long as you can recognize that that's problematic, which really shouldn't be a problem for many people today. You know, most people can read an Agatha Christie novel and go, ooh, that's a little rough. You know, like, we spot the rough patches in this work. So it's
like, ooh, and push it aside.
Wow, yeah, that's rough. I mean, good book, but yeah, that's a little something. So yeah. Anyway, I don't even remember where we were.
Slightly off track for sure.
So the mustache, am I right?
Oh boy. It's weird the slurs it kept muttering.
Oh man, the mustache was the most problematic character.
Not curvy enough, in my opinion.
I say too curvy.
Oh, okay. All right.
Interesting. Wow. Different sides of the coin.
That's it. I wanted it to... I feel like it was bigger last movie, but...
I wonder if he'll have it at all in the next one.
Ooh.
Interesting.
One half very curvy, one half is shaved off.
Do you like Kenneth Branagh as Poirot?
Oh, I love him.
I think he's really great, yeah.
He is brilliant. One of the scenes that stands out the most is the most unimportant scene. But in the very beginning, when he goes to, like, the club, restaurant, whatever, and he witnesses the drama on the dance floor. But he's just there eating by himself.
He's just observing, yeah.
And he's rearranging these little pastries that he's ordered. Yes. He has to have... six specifically.
It has to be like an even number or something.
Yeah, it has to be in a triangle, but he can't figure out which one to pick. And then he's like, ooh, like, just those little things. I'm like, this is a quirky character, and I love it.
The waiter grabs one. He's like, no, not that one. And then he can make up his mind. I like when he's talking to the blues singer. I can't remember her name. And he likes her, and he just starts rambling about, like, growing the perfect vegetable.
Yes.
And he's very flustered. And it is one of the very few times we see him not have all his shit together. Not know what to say. Not know all the perfect things. And he, you know, it is that theme of, like, love trips you up. It makes you a different person.
I love both of them together, though. Because even, like, he... asks her, like, why do you wear that outdated hat? Maybe you should take it off. And the daughter gets defensive, and she's like, he's asking because he already knows. She knows what he's up to. She gets him.
Well, and she even is like, oh, you have to be... she basically is like, this is all about your ego. She tells him, you know, oh, you're the great Poirot and all that. And... at the end, he does come out and he goes, yes, I do this to satisfy my ego. I do this. I make a big show of it. And yes, I want everybody to say how clever. I love that he cops to it by the end of the movie. He is saying, like, you're right. That is why I do this.
That is the daughter that says that, though.
That's what I mean. Because she already knows, or he already knows, you know, what's in your hat.
Mm-hmm.
And, but yeah, I think this this character of Poirot he's very layered, and I think Branagh plays him that way really well. He brings out different sides of him.
I like that we're not getting just a computer kind of like Sherlock Holmes tends to be. But like I feel like even a different actor would probably portray Poirot as kind of robotic or very focused and he is focused on certain things, but he has a liveliness, a sweetness to him. Like in the last movie where he's introduced measuring his eggs, and like he needs a very specific egg for his omelet.
Right.
I don't even know if you remember that scene, but
I get what you're. I mean, it's everything. He has an appreciation for everything being just right.
Yes.
Like even when he's like pointing out clues in this as like the hospital corners on the beds and the way the beds are made and like everything is so particular, and he takes it all in the way that, like, I know we're comparing Sherlock Holmes a lot because it's an easy comparison, but it is the same way. But you're right, he spits it back in a different way. It's getting easier every time I do it to criticize Sherlock, and I like Benedict Cumberbatch, but he does. He plays Holmes like a computer that's an asshole. Mm-hmm. Like, that's it. There is no emotion there. There is no, even when he's like strung out, he's not playing it with any emotion. And Branagh plays this in a way of like, you sort of understand, like, there's almost like a poet's soul in this very logical person.
Yeah, because
he has an appreciation for things like the pyramids, and like he appreciates art, and he appreciates a book, but he can also analyze somebody's handwriting in a book. You know, like he appreciates Dickens and numbers.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
he likes the jazz music, although I didn't expect
the blues.
To,
yeah, he's like, he's... I like your blues music. I did not expect to like it, but yeah, I love that part of it, and his not quite romance with the singer, because they are so mismatched.
Yes,
but she's very charmed with him at the same time.
I think what gets me is not that he's an appreciator of very specific things, but that he's not a disapproving person. He doesn't judge.
For sure.
Like you don't get the sense that he's like, everything's not perfect. My life is ruined. Like, he's not going to judge you for having your clothes not quite right to his standards. Like, he just appreciates certain things more, and he sees the effort and everything.
It's not like a low hanging fruit portrayal of OCD.
Yeah.
You know, it is very much just an observer kind of thing. But like his desserts, he does want to have them like lined up perfectly. He does want the perfect egg for himself. But you're right, he's not correcting everybody else's shit. He just notices when something's out of place.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good subtlety to the character that I think it keeps him from being unlikable.
And I think the reason this character is so well defined and just so good is because of Kenan Branagh.
Kenneth Branagh.
Kenneth Branagh. I will eventually learn his name. He's portraying the character, but he's also directing the movie.
Right.
And he's an executive producer, meaning he has some say over the script and characterization. He is very much in love with this character, and he has this character inside him.
It does feel like this is almost like a passion project for Kenneth Branagh, that he's like always loved. He's a old school like Shakespearean actor. And he's directed and starred in, stage and screen versions of Shakespeare, but he's also like directed Thor, because Thor is very Shakespearean. But you do get a sense that he loves this material, and that's why he is, kind of spearheaded these movies.
Yeah. And so I feel like we just wouldn't get the same thing with a different actor, different director, or whatever.
That's entirely possible. That is, you know, sort of, he's crafted this role around what he feels Poirot is.
Yeah, like he has his history vision of it.
Right. We've seen Kenneth Branagh twice before on our podcast.
Okay. What in?
He's the bad guy in Tenet.
Oh, yeah, I knew that.
He's the husband of the love interest in that. And he is one of the British officers in Dunkirk. On the beach trying to evacuate, waiting for the transports to come in. He is Commander Bolton in Dunkirk.
He's so sort of the commanding officer.
He's one of one of the officers, I think, on the dock.
I think I know what scene. Yeah.
You know, when what's his name, like, grabbed the stretcher and we're trying to kind of sneak on the boat. I think he's one of the officers there.
Okay.
But yeah. So we've actually seen Kenneth Branagh a few times. He's in a movie I'm gonna just recommend here. I didn't realize he was in this. It's called Pirate Radio in the United States, and in the UK it's called The Boat That Rocked, and it's about a group of guys in the 70s who were in like the English Channel on a boat running a pirate radio station and broadcasting their signal out from, so they were offshore and they couldn't be caught or something like that.
And that's a movie?
It's a movie. A bunch of people, like Bill Nighy's in that, Nick Frost is in that. It's a really kind of cool movie from, I'm going to say, the early 2000s.
Interesting.
Kenneth Branagh. Love him. What else you got, Oz?
I don't know if I have any other thoughts I wanted to touch on. I think I wanted to talk about Rosalia and how she called out Perot.
Okay.
But we already kind of touched on that
a little bit. Yeah. You have anything else on that, or
just, I love, that he seems taken back by it and wants to apologize. He doesn't he chases after her rather than just letting her leave. And he really wants to work it out with her. But even then, like you said, he owns it. So he's like, you're correct, but I didn't mean to offend you.
Right. Yeah. He is, I don't know. I love the way he owns it. He's like, you're right. I do this for my, I love when somebody has a character flaw that they get called out on. Not just in this, but in real life. And I've tried to be better about this myself. When people call me out on something and just going like, no, you're right. That is what I do.
I do that.
And,
yes.
And here, you know, sometimes it's like, I'll try to be better at that. And sometimes it's like, no, I do this because I like to do this. And I don't mean to piss anybody off. You know, and it's just sort of like a, I think everybody needs to be better at owning things. So when I see a character, especially a character as likable as this, when I see him do that and go, no, you're right. I love to hear people tell me how clever I am.
And I'm good at
it. And I am clever. And I just want to be recognized for that. And I'm just kind of like, yeah, I like that. I like that a lot.
I do like it. And I like that, you know, this movie, like, that scene was great, but it was unexpected to hear anyone call out Perot. Like he's this untouchable figure almost in these times. Like, we don't really know why he's so renowned. Like, he's renowned even before we meet him and Murder on the Orient Express. Like, I don't know what his rise to fame looks like, but just everyone seems to know him and love him. And it's just like, here's this person who is not afraid to be like, you're rude and you judged me just then.
Right. I think there's, I always wonder when I see a movie like from this time period like this, where there is a famous detective and then you get like Sherlock Holmes, who's a famous detective. I'm like, was there a time when detectives were like famous people? Like,
no, you know what there I was mean? Not.
That's what what would make somebody a famous, I guess, if you solved like a huge case and all the newspapers picked it up, like, I guess you would have some level of fame. maybe. But yeah, it is.
It's like the lawyers who are currently famous in like the Johnny Depp Amber Heard case. Like, like everyone's like watching that, but that doesn't happen like in real life with like detectives and stuff.
Like That's not a thing. The dream team from the O.J. Simpson trial. Like, that's it, Johnny Cochran, and
that's the closest real world comparison.
It kind of is. Mark Furman, all the L.A. cops who were famous for being horribly racist. And it's just like, by the way, take this opportunity to plug our episode for Once Upon a Time in Mexico, starring Johnny Depp. It's in the archives, so check it out. But yeah, that's all I have. I really enjoyed this movie, like I enjoyed Murder on the Orient Express. And I hope they make more of these. I would love to see Poirot come back and Kenneth Branagh be a part of that. Or another Agatha Christie character that would take place like in this universe. Again, in the same way, like these stories are not connected, but, you know, just in the same style of movie as this.
I do have good news for you then.
Oh, all right.
Because I looked this up. I was very curious because, as you said, like, critical reception has not been... Critical reception's been good. Audience reception
for this...
Some people, it's the canceled thing. Some people, it's just in general, they, like, feel like this is too well-polished of a movie, or for whatever reason.
I think this is a movie that is aimed at an audience that is not the general big movie demographic. The 18 to 35, I don't think it's as male heavy as it used to be, but that group. I think this is a movie aimed at an older audience, honestly. I think like my age to like my parents' age would go see, you know, sort of like when war movies come out. They're not aimed at us. They're aimed at like our boomer dads that, you know, go to see like, it's like the, you see the commercials of like, don't turn into your parents.
Yeah.
And it's like, who else reads submarine books? And the guy's like, my dad. And it's like, it's like those kinds of, and it's now no shade on that. When I'm older, I want people to make movies that are aimed at me too. Like, but no, I think this movie, the appeal is for an older audience, and I do think it's there. I just don't know if it gets theatrically released anymore.
This is a movie for English teachers. This kind is a of. Movie for grandpas. And it works. But I did look this up, and the man who wrote, Michael Green, he wrote this movie.
Okay.
The screenplay. He also wrote Murder on the Orient Express.
He's adapting the Agatha Christie
stuff.
He
is already working on, he's penning a new one. They haven't announced the name, but they teased that it's one of the lesser known Poirot stories, and that the same studio who does these, I don't know what.
Was it The Case of the Black Voter? Was it Agatha Christie's unpublished manuscript to her manifesto against?
It's her alt-right phase. My God.
Agatha QAnon.
Dad, please. Can't even make it. I can't get my thoughts out. Your bad puns. There was also something being said about a shared universe, and I didn't understand what that meant because I didn't know. I thought all of Agatha Christie's murder mysteries were under Poirot. So now I'm assuming that. What you said, like, they are going to pick another one of her detectives.
There's a bunch of detectives that she would write.
I do hope that gets done. Like, I'm worried about how this movie was received because, you know, the audience isn't as big as a studio expects to make millions of dollars. But I like what we have here, and I want to see more of it. So whether it's a shorter budget for the next movies or whatnot, but like I do want to see more of this.
I I agree. There's something really good here, and as far as budget, I would almost wager that most of the budget of these movies is for cast.
Yeah, because they are a star-studded cast.
Because they're, like, if you look at this one, and even Orient Express, this one has some great shots of the Nile and, you know, just kind of B-roll shots. But then, like, other shots is green screened, and the green screen looks bad. It doesn't even look good.
Yeah,
and I remember, like, Murder on the Orient Express looking a lot of the same way when they would do wide shots outside the train and stuff like that. Uh-huh. It was really, like, kind of cheap looking green screen.
There's in this movie in particular, there's the shot where Book is getting off of the pyramid.
Yes.
And
oh, that's so bad.
It's just, like, they didn't even do anything with it. You can just see the green screen.
All the pyramid sequence there is really bad. But then once they get on the boat and on the actual Nile, there's some great cinematography happening there.
There is.
So it is like, okay, you went there and you shot this, but they can't get a good, like, backdrop even off of the pyramid.
There had to be some short cuts,
right,
in order to make do with the budget for the cinematography.
I'm sure filming on the actual pyramids is not an easy thing to get.
Oh no, that's totally fine.
But, like, it's shocking how bad that scene looks. It's really bizarre. I do like the idea of flying a kite off the pyramid, though.
I thought that was the most ridiculous part of this movie.
I thought the most ridiculous part is he's like, you're defiling the pyramid. And then, like, Armie Hammer and Gal Gadot are, like, having sex in a pyramid. You're like, you're fine with this, but
you're like, I appreciate Zeox.
But not a kite. Kites are where I draw the line.
Kites are too much.
That's it. That's all I got on this. I enjoyed this, and I think, contrary to popular opinion, I think this is worth a look if you can get past, and I understand there is more to the Armie Hammer story than the fact that he's supposedly a cannibal, that he had some serious allegations about abuse, just in general, across several partners. I understand there's some stuff, there's some baggage to get over with some of these people, but if you can and you want a fun, I think this is a fun Saturday afternoon movie.
I think
both of these movies are just, they're fun mystery stories. If you like Knives Out and you like that style of mystery, I'd say give both of these a chance. I'll throw in the recommendation for Orient Express as well. I enjoy both of these movies.
Yeah. And I think Knives Out is a good, I mean, it's
Knives Out is great. Yes.
It's a love letter to these movies.
For sure.
So it makes sense. And a lot of people who have seen Knives Out haven't seen Agatha Christie novels. They haven't read them and they haven't seen adaptations. So, like, give it a shot.
Knives Out and upcoming Knives Out 2, I'm sure, will be the same kind of thing where it is a throwback to these kind of, like, even Daniel Craig is playing, like, this eccentric, kind of idiot, but kind of brilliant at the same time character, you know.
Knives Out 2. More knives.
More
knives. Out.
You won't believe how out these knives are. We've got the gayest knives ever.
Who's naming these? The Fast and Furious guys?
Well played, sir. All right. Let's move on to shout-outs.
Shout things out.
What do you got this week? You want me to go?
I'll go. It's my turn.
How about it?
I wanted to shout out a TikTok account. I cannot pronounce this for the life of me, but it's a silly joke name, and there will be a link below. But it's Dr. Glaucoma? Glaucoma something. There's a pun in there, but I don't understand it because it's medical terms. But this is a doctor. He's a real doctor.
He's an eye doctor, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
He creates these really funny skits where he plays the pharmacy or he plays surgery, like the departments that you would find in a hospital. Right. And he kind of uses these to tell stories about his workplace in a really funny way, but also like a serious way. Like he talks about like the insurance abuse and how, like, you know, the insurance right. companies need you to do this or that, and pharmacy, and like how certain doctors will just over prescribe things, but he like does it in such a funny way,
right,
that I really think everyone should check him out and look at his skits, because it's like, it's SNL level funny, but it's all one guy playing different doctors.
Different roles, yeah.
So yeah, that is... Oh, and then he has a family doctor, and he's got like Hello Kitty scrubs for that, and it's great.
I love when someone can do commentary, like satire, and be just actually funny about it. I feel like a lot of satire is more trying to make a point than... The comedy is almost the afterthought, but someone like South Park can comment on something in the news and also be super funny about it. And if this guy is able to be funny while still poking fun at the medical industry, like, and kind of calling them out on the bullshit, like, that's pretty cool.
It is cool.
Nice.
What are you shouting out today,
sir? I'm shouting out David Peterson and his Twitch channel. David Peterson is a comic creator and artist. He created the graphic novel series Mouse Guard. And he's also done, I think, some Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle stuff. And he has a Twitch channel where he makes art pretty regularly. He'll either be working on... comics, working on commissions. Sometimes he's coloring pages, and you get to see his process, and he answers questions from the audience. He's been doing it for a really long time, and it's just kind of one of the most consistent art streamers, I think, on Twitch.
I think it's interesting because, like, being a good artist and being a good, like, live stream personality yeah. are two very different things. So sometimes I find, like, really great artists, but I'm like, I can't sit in your stream for more than 10 minutes
because yeah.
it's boring. But, like, it's good when you find someone who's able to talk about their art and
I've tried to do streams, and it's really hard for me. I, you know, to keep an eye on the chat and everything, and a lot of times it's just a little too much for me. I'd rather make videos as opposed to doing it live.
Yeah.
But I did do a live stream podcast some years ago with Carrie McGinnis and Imran Javed from Jock and Nerd, and it was called Sketching Comedy, and we talked about artists and comedians, and we drew while it was going on. And we talked about David Peterson one time, and we had tweeted out that we were going to be talking about it, and he ended up jumping into our live stream. And so
that's
incredible. I wanted to just shout that out, that on top of being a great artist and streamer, he's also a super nice guy. He was very generous with his time and, you know, kind of came on and spent an hour with us and answered questions and things like that. And he's just I think, just a really generous and just genuinely nice guy. So I think he does make that effort. That's part of what makes him good at streaming, is he does make that effort to connect with people who come on his stream and say, you know, says hi to everybody and answers questions and, you know, kind of has conversations back and forth. He's a good egg.
A good egg.
So that's David Peterson, and I'll have a link to his Twitch account. You can just go there and subscribe to his feed, and it'll let you know when he's going live. He goes afternoons, I think, a lot of times he's streaming live. But on that note, I want to thank you for listening to this, our final regular episode of the season of The Picture Show with Austin and Phil Rude. If you enjoy our show, please leave a review on your podcatcher of choice. It helps our visibility. It helps us grow the show.
That's right. And guess what? There are plenty of ways to help us grow the show.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Another way is to tell a friend. Now,
I'm rich. I don't have any real friends.
Oh, well, then it looks like no one's going to listen to our show. And it's your fault. But, you know, if we would like to hire you to kind of keep an eye out on your friends and make sure they're listening our show and not dating
not band dating managers. Our competitors.
That's right. That was a horrible...
This is a hard movie to line that up with.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
Anyway, next week...
Will be our season review. We're gonna review what we looked at, what we liked this season, what we didn't like maybe, what was new to us. It'll be a short wrap-up, and we'll give you a little hint at what we're looking at for... next season.
That's right. Season 5.
Season 5. Wow.
That's crazy.
Wrapping up our 4th season of this, going on 2 years doing this. We've come a long way, baby.
We sure have.
So that'll be next week. It'll just be a quick wrap-up. And if you want to let us know what you discovered this year, you know, let us know. Give us a shout-out. Or shoot us a message on social media, and we'll shout you out on the show.
Yeah, what's our audience pick?
Yeah, let us know. Hit us up on Twitter. Austin, where can they hit you up on Twitter with those shout outs?
They can hit me up on Twitter. I am at Elon Musk. No, wait. Sorry. No. I am Austin N. Rude for my typical account. And if you are a Doctor Who nerd, follow me at Old Who Review.
And I am at Phil Rude on Twitter, at PhilRude75 on Instagram, PhilRude.com for all of our episodes and all the places you can reach me, and ko-fi.com/PhilRude, where you can buy me a coffee or buy yourself a book. Also, go troll Elon Musk on Twitter.
Please.
Yeah. Austin, you want to read the credits?
Yep, we do it all ourselves.
There you have it. We'll see you next time on The Picture Show.
See ya.
Not long ago, there were only 3 television channels, and the cheaply made family man comedy was king. Turning the dial would only give you another glimpse into a suburban nuclear family with a breadwinner husband, a stay-at-home wife, and the occasional talking horse. That is until 1964, when one show dared to take a glimpse into the lives of terrible monsters that lived next door. The Munsters premiered that September, and well, America has yet to recover. The Munster Hunter shuns the millions of hours of original shows that are available at the press of a button to take a look back at a 60-year-old comedy about a Frankenstein monster and his grotesque family.
He reaches down and he just grabs her by the butt and lifts her up.
Yep. Instead of opening the window, he punches through the window. Which, I mean, this is your damn window, man.
By the way, he's trying to catch the raven out of the clock.
Oh, is that what he's doing to feed the cat?
Yeah.
I was very disinterested, to be honest. The Munster Hunters, available every Monday wherever you get your podcasts.